Welcome back to Hear Us Out. Today we're joined by an artist whose creative range is off the charts. You probably know him as the multi-instrumentalist from OAR, where his keys, percussion, and harmonies have helped shape the band's unmistakable sound. But Michael Paris is so much more than that. Before OAR, he was in Stomp, and he's brought his unique guitar drumming technique to stages everywhere, blending rhythm and melody in a way that's totally his own. He's also worked alongside iconic artists like Pink and carved out his own solo path with Toon Trek, a one-of-a-kind series that explores hidden historic spaces through music and storytelling. There's a lot to cover, so let's get into it. Michael Paris, welcome to Hear Us Out.
Hey, it's good to be here. That was a great intro. Thank you for being so comprehensive. That was
great. Thank you. So first thing I have to ask you about is whenever I see the band, you always look like you're having so much fun.
Oh my God.
Tell us about the experience of being up on stage with the guys in OAR and you just convey this energy of positivity up there. Tell us more.
I mean, it's the big payoff of years and years of piano lessons and band and music school and all of that's the dream. The dream is to be on stage performing for a living. So I don't care where I am, how many people are there, you know, it's that feeling is always kind of the same, you know. And okay, if I'm battling a cold or sick, whatever, if there's something else going on, fine. Then, but how could I not be just joyful and just so happy to be? That's my happy place, you know. That's like
it
2 hours of happy place and therapy and positive reinforcement, you know, all those things that we all need a little bit of every day if possible. It's so interesting playing with the band too, because there's some ways that I play piano with the band that I don't have songs of my own where I play like that. Mm-hmm. So it's also satisfying, a little bit of a different genre as far as what I get to play in compared to sort of what my solo stuff is. Not that there aren't connections there. There are strong connections there. But it's so just constantly rewarding. And every time there's new music, it's exciting and diving into new stuff. And everything about the process, you know, celebrating 20 years this October.
Wow.
It's pretty wild.
That's the longest job I've ever had. That's for sure.
I'm trying to get
tenure with the band. if that's something they do, I don't know. I'm going to ask. Or a Rolex, right? I mean, 20
or
years.
Or a pension.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what it feels like to achieve success alongside OAR versus to achieve success in your solo work? Does that feel the same or are there differences?
Yeah, that's a good question. The band was already successful when I started playing with them. So I just sort of jumped on that. You know, really 6 months after I started with the band in 2005, we were playing Madison Square Garden. You know, it was just like, you know, jump into the pool. Thankfully, I knew how to swim, you know, in this case. And I had some experience with Pink playing some bigger places and arenas and everything. And I understood what that felt like. And that's a whole other discussion as far as how that feels. Playing my creations. Now, you know, we have to understand, too, that most of the songs when I started with the band too, they're already written. Most of the bands that are songs that are written now, you know, are the main songwriters, Mark, Richie, and Jerry gets in there. Then there's some group stuff. But for the most part, my main creative expression, as far as the things that I create, are in my solo work. Hmm. Now, I've gotten to create with the band over the past 20 years, definitely parts. There was a lot of songs that didn't have keyboards. Mm-hmm. When Jerry sent me 8 CDs to start familiarizing myself. And I was like, who are these guys? You know, because I really wasn't that familiar with them in 2005. I missed the whole Ohio State thing and the Columbus thing and then the Maryland thing. I was Connecticut boy. So I was over there north, you know, northeast, secluded from the rest of the country. And that's not true. So there is this different sense of accomplishment for me when I write something, finish it, which I've been doing finally the last 2 years, release it, form it. It's because it's like they're my babies. Mm-hmm. So there is that different feeling of knowing that I created those and now I'm sharing it and I've released them into the universe kind of feeling. Now, as far as with the songs that that I play with the band, I do have to take them on as if they are songs that I wrote. for me to really do them justice, for me to really perform them emotionally and feel as connected as they do when they play some of those songs that existed 30 years ago. It's ridiculous. So same thing with Stomp. You know, that's the kind of performer I am. Like, you see that. I can't phone. There's no phoning it in. I'm thankful for every performance I get to do. And you don't know if it's going to be the last one, whatever. We don't know what the future holds and all that. But there's just, same thing with Stomp. I had to sort of take that show on as if I had been part of creating it to really do it justice. And that's just been I guess, my makeup. And it continues to be. But how does my makeup look, by the way? I did just a little bit. No.
It's a good look. So
I live streamed like every day starting, you know, when the tour got canceled. And I had my green screen studio set up, multiple cameras. I was so picky and finicky about the lighting and everything about it. And today I'm scrambling to get my laptop set up and ready and just throw it together and blur up my background. But all is well. Every experience is new and exciting. So I'm thankful to be here talking with you guys.
We're very happy to have you. And so you just released a new single, Mother, with our buddy, Stephen Kellogg. He actually helped us get started, was our first guest.
Very first one.
What? I got to text him right now. No. Can I call him right now? And
get absolutely.
So, well, that's awesome.
We were looking to start this up. We reached out to him and said, hey, how do you feel about being a guest on our new show? And he said, I'm available next Monday. And it was one of those, I guess we're starting next Monday.
That's friggin' awesome.
Good guy.
I'm a big fan of his, fellow Connecticut boy. And I just remember seeing Stephen Kellogg and the Sixers open up for OAR my first year or two, 06. 07 maybe, and just going, okay, I'm in love with you. And sitting in with them on Piano Man, I kind of like, hey, I want to sit in with you. I know you guys are doing that song. Let me just, and then that was just the beginning of sort of that type of in awe of him and inspired by him and starting a friendship with him. So like many special guests that I'm starting to bring into songs, there's this sort of cathartic feeling for me of something I've been thinking about with this person for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and finally having them on something. And I, you know, I was like, I've been so motivated and proactive about sort of getting these guests to be a part of my songs. I mean, I drove to Connecticut with my recording gear to Steven's house, and I recorded his guitar and vocals, and I got some incredible footage, and he was so gracious and a great host. And if that's what it takes for me to kind of get these songs finished in the way that I feel like they deserve to be finished. That song in particular, Mother, I mean, that's one of the early songs I really started experimenting with my guitar drumming in not just the, I know we haven't talked about specifics of the guitar drumming yet, but it's basically dad fad. So it's an open tuning where the F is a F natural or an F sharp. And I was focused on that. And then I was like, well, let me try dad gad and see what comes out of that tuning. And Mother's the song that came out of that. So that song's been with me, you know, since my Stomp days. So that's over two decades. So that there's multiple reasons why it's cathartic for that song to finally be friggin' finished and released. And I just performed it. Performing it again feels great. You know, it was one of the first songs I ever performed in front of an audience doing this style of guitar drumming. San Francisco, it was like an open mic. I was on tour with Stomp, had my guitar. Let me just go in. And then I remember this one girl just like, she was talking to somebody and just stopped and was just like, wow. Like I heard her exclaim out loud and I was like, okay, maybe I'm onto something here just a little bit. Let me just keep pursuing it. And having the confidence to do that, to pursue something different. When we get that from all sorts of places, my inspiration certainly was Luke and Steve, the creators of Stomp, who were on the streets of Brighton busking with trash cans, you know, and people walking by going, what do you do? Like, what are you doing? And they're like, now we're onto something here. It's not just trash cans, okay? It's all these other things too. And they really sort of instilled in that idea of like, pursue your crazy ideas, you know, pursue your inventions, the things that you're excited about, and see and take them to their fruition as far as you can take them. And so this journey with this guitar drumming, I keep pointing over here, you know, with my to my Martin, which I just got like last year. I love it so much. This journey's been, constantly evolving and honing the technique and skill so that it's not a gimmick. It's just another way that I write songs, you know?
Did you present the song to Steven or did you collaborate on it? We were talking, we had a conversation with Robert Randolph recently, and he was saying like,
he'll be in the middle of a song, kind of feel stuck with it, and give Steven a call and be like, hey, help me out here.
That's cool. It's not that I've ever been stuck. That song has pretty much been written.
The lyrics also, not just the music.
Yeah, everything. Everything was pretty written about it. But what I wanted to do with some of these songs that have been with me for a while is again, that's another motivation for the guest artist, somebody that has meaning to me, not just somebody that is going to get me numbers or whatever for a marketing thing. No, it's to infuse some of these songs with this fresh perspective. So I sent him just a very rough mix of the basic tracking that I had. Said, you know, I'd really like you to sing a verse and figure out what you're singing in the choruses. And if you hear any lyrics, you know, take the second verse. If you hear any lyrics, feel free to just, you know, make them your own and take what I have as a springboard. If you don't want to change anything, that's fine too. You know, and I'm a real fan of with these collabs and having guests is, you know, you give people something. You give people a cut of whatever it is for their, even if they didn't even really write anything, just the fact that you're on here with me, you know, here's something on the back end. Like I've always felt like that's really important just in case, you know, just in case the song all of a sudden, you know, gets, you know, 100 million listens or whatever. Okay. So who knows, you know, I'm doing this all independently right now. So, you know, for me, like 5,000 is like, whoa, kidding me? That's great.
Awesome.
Every listen counts. Something you mentioned earlier was that you have to go on when you're playing with OAR, you have to go on as if you wrote the songs yourself with that same kind of feeling. How do you achieve that when you were not part of the original formation and creation of those earlier stuff? How do you channel that of incorporating it as your own? Or do you ever still feel like the new guy even after 20 years?
Yes to all. Yes, yes, yes. You know, when I started, was all I was doing was listening to OAR. That's the first thing that helps. Just everywhere you go, headphones, just listening. It's not so much about, and it's listening, and then visualizing what I'm doing in the song, which they say is as good reinforcement as actually sitting there and doing it. Every show that I played for those first 2 years, maybe with the band, I got the recordings from that show, and I was in the back lounge of the bus after the show, listening and taking notes on myself. And I just think that it was like, I just did like a full immersion. I just did like a deep dive. Like, I'm going to go learn a language. I'm going to go move to that country. It was kind of that feeling of all I'm thinking about sleeping, you know, daytime is this band's song and understanding their language and their vocabulary, because every band is different. And I got that, you know, doing Stomp too was like, this is a new language and vocabulary, and how do we communicate with each other on stage doing this stuff with a kitchen sink? Like this was different. So playing with these guys, it was really about understanding, you know, how do they write, you know, and what is the emotion behind the writing, and what is the instrumentation that really has been sort of part of the grounding of this band, you know, sounds. And I remember the one note Jerry gave me early on, because I was kind of taking Butch Taylor's involvement with Dave Matthews.
Dave, yeah.
Listener supported. I was listening to that nonstop. It was so good.
I was at that show.
Well, I might want to hear about that later.
Still have the shirt.
That's awesome. One of my favorite live records still to this day. So I was sort of like, okay, I'm seeing how he sort of has slotted in as a keyboardist with DMB. I sort of was like, okay, well, let me sort of like follow that model a little bit. So it was more, he played a lot more piano. And that was a sound that wasn't really so prevalent in the OAR song. So I just remember that one time, the one note Jerry gave me early on, he just was like, less piano. Got it. Okay. So Rhodes, Whirly, organs, clavs, some piano for some moments, about an hour ago or whatever, you know, Mr. Moon, things like that, where it is really appropriate. But pretty much more of that stuff, the more electric keys and organs and pads and, you know, interesting synth sounds. I tried to integrate more of the synth stuff, I will say. Listen, I have my dream rig with this band. Like, I couldn't have dreamt of a better risor stage setup for me. They were so supportive of me developing sort of my world over there and allowing me to explore and experiment. And I don't play keyboards on every song. There's songs I only play percussion and maybe sing a little bit. You know, what is my journey? And that's another thing that keeps that keeps...
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here! Right now, score up to 80% off everything home. These are our best deals of the year. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
It's fresh for me. And to go back to your earlier question about, Michelle, about how do I keep that feeling of they're my songs, is having the freedom for when I... This is what the band does naturally anyway. Every time we play a song from one night to the next, it's never exactly the same. It's never exactly the same. Maybe there's a single or one of the big hits that more or less the structure doesn't really change so much. But for the most part, there's always shucking and jiving and improv moments and looseness and following Mark, you know, and he maybe just decides to go somewhere else on a certain song or not. I knew that that was the attitude from the beginning. So when I approach these songs, part of what helps me, I think, feel like they are mine is that I have this freedom to play them differently from one night to the next. I'm not playing the same parts. I'm not playing the exact same phrases or melodies sometimes, or maybe in this song I decided, you know what, I'm going to try playing the organ in the verse and the whirly in the chorus maybe. Like, and there's that freedom to be able to change that up for most of the songs in, you know, that the band plays. So it really, I think that's part of why it does help me feel like these are my songs. And also playing them for 20 years, you know, and I haven't played all of them for 20 years, obviously, because there's been writing constantly, but to play them and play them and play them and play them and to play them always differently. That's the key.
Putting your own spin on it.
And have the freedom to not have to, listen, some people as musicians and performers, I remember in Stomp, there was people that did the same solo every night for 10 years, but it was awesome. It was an amazing solo, and they needed that consistency and grounding, I guess, to know that they were going to nail that moment in the show that consistently that night. I was trying to do not something different every night, but I would like always try to like change it up. You know, like once the triangle solo it started to get too prevalent and people were coming and making the triangle signal, Mark was like, all right, we're going to give that a rest just for a little bit. And I think that he's really smart about that. It's like, we're not performing. And that's something I learned from Stomp too. You're not performing for laughs. Don't go for the laughs. When you're playing music and performing, you know, don't go for the applause. Don't beg, you know, for that. It should be organic and come naturally. So I think, you know, when something like that starts to become a little bit of a gimmick, the triangle moment, always getting, we're waiting for it and we're making signs and everything. Let's give that a little bit of a rest because we don't want that to start to become something regular. Don't get me started talking because I will just.
Good. We like it.
Yeah, we like to sit back and listen. That's our kind of our MO here.
Nice.
I've listened to you speak before about the specific guitars that you will play for guitar drumming. I have an interest in guitars. We had Brian Calhoun from Rockbridge on to talk about building, and you said that you play Rockbridge for some of the guitar drumming. Have you figured out any sort of changes within the build and the customizations of what you've played to have the instrument be durable for what you're asking of it?
I mean, I love the Rockbridge. I love
which wood did you choose?
It's so. I mean,
now we're gonna get Eric started.
Now I'm gonna have to pause and go get it. If you want me to show it to you, I mean,
sure,
I
go
run
for
downstairs
it
and get it
if you'd like to. Sure.
So Eric wants to see it.
I will. The Rockbridge was great. It was that last show of tour, Spring Fling 2020 in March, and Richie and I walked to Brian Calhoun's the place, Rockbridge Guitars,
in the basement.
He showed me a bunch of different models. I showed him how I play, and then we went and picked out our wood in the basement and everything. It was awesome. And this was during when the pandemic started, and we still got our guitars relatively quickly. And it's the best sounding guitar I've ever played. I mean, that hands down, it's a little delicate as far as the knocking and the pounding. I actually messed up the pickup, and I just got a new pickup installed with these sensors. So I'm still experimenting.
Oh, interesting.
But because I've been flying so much, I've been taking the Martin, and the Martin is a solid top. When I went and got this on tour in Salina, Kansas, because the Rockbridge pickup failed, I was like, I need the most durable, like solid top, great pickup, that I could beat the shit out of, you know?
Yeah.
And it was this girl, this woman's last day, and she showed me some stuff, and I picked up, you know, this, I just picked up this solid top, and I just,
mahogany.
Oh, man, you know, this is when I need to know what the wood is made of. See, not being a real guitarist.
I think that's
being
mahogany.
Being this hybrid, it's, so the sustain of this, and it's the intonation compared to what I had been playing, this is like night and day, as is the Rockbridge. It's just taking this for my fly dates and plugging in and going into my acoustic DI and everything, and not freaking out so much when I take it out in airplanes. It's still, you know, whatever, $1,500 guitar, but I'm gonna reserve the Rockbridge for like studio and like local shows where maybe I know I can just put it in the vehicle and go and have it, or maybe I use it for just like one or two songs where I'm not beating the shit out of it. Where I'm doing more sensitive playing, that's a good idea. That's what I should do, actually. I need a new stand, and I'll need a double guitar. Let me make some notes about my next shopping list. For the
there you go.
Here. I'm kidding.
It could make you a double neck with instead of it being a 6 and a 12, just with different action.
But as far as the construction of it, right? When I first started playing, I made a cushion for this part.
Okay.
So that it would flatten it out, because that sits...
Yep.
Here. And when I play sitting down, the guitar sits a little further away from me. So I wanted a little more distance between the strings, right? As opposed to here where my arms kind of push back. This was really more comfortable. So when I can get a guitar company to make me a custom guitar drumming guitar, I actually want to design a new body. I think where it actually kind of cradles around my waist a little bit, and the strings are that distance. So it's almost like there would be more material here, but it would kind of go like it would go like that kind of. It would be weird, and you probably couldn't play it the other way so comfortably. It would be a guitar drumming guitar, really. You know, it'd be really made for this style.
And do you only have one pickup in your guitar for drumming?
This one is just a saddle pickup.
Uh-huh.
The Rockbridge has the saddle, and then it has sensors all around the body with separate controls. It's a Fishman Power Tap.
Okay.
A separate control to blend, and then it has a stereo out so you can separate those pickups, the saddle pickups and the sensors. And so sometimes the only thing that I don't get enough out of the Martin, so maybe I'll put like another mic up on it, is some of the knocking.
Okay.
The saddle one just doesn't pick up on this one quite as much, because I'm doing most of the knocking here, you know, or here. I'm not really doing it here ever, which I guess this would pick up.
Yeah, the saddle would pick that up. Yeah. When we spoke with Mike Dawes, we were talking about the construction of his guitar, and he has four pickups built into it. And he specifically worked with the builder, who was a fingerstyle builder, to do what he needs. The construction of it was fascinating, and like reinforced tops and different bracing, and that I find that fascinating.
Sometimes I think that this is going to turn into a guitar podcast.
I want to look at one of those hybrid guitars too, where it's graphite.
Yep.
And then wood around the back and the side, because I'm wondering if that, I don't know. Again, I like the knocking of the wood, so yeah. I don't know what how the tone of the graphite would change it, but I know that it could probably withstand. It'd be a lot stronger.
Interesting.
Because it was a graphite top. Anyway,
fascinates
me. You want to see the Rockbridge?
Bring it out. Nerding out here.
I can tell. You sure you don't want a side podcast about just guitars?
No. Then I'll ultimately expose my lack of knowledge.
You have plenty of knowledge. I was going to say, when you can tell what kind of wood it is through a recording, you know it too well.
It's the look of it. Mahogany has a very distinct look, and I very well could be wrong.
I think you're right. I have a feeling.
Yeah.
I don't know. Not that I was listening that whole time, but I realized that I still had my earpiece in. Okay, so... Ooh, are you excited? Oh boy.
Yes.
Let me see if I can do the grand reveal here. Let me see how to do the reveal. So probably show you the side first. Yeah, okay. Ready?
Okay.
Here it comes. So,
that's pretty.
And so I had this put along the edge as opposed to the back, right?
Uh-huh.
Because I play like that.
That's some nice sapwood on the sides.
And then,
that's,
you know.
That's pretty. Yep.
Yeah. So...
I love how they blend the color of the neck to the color of the wood.
It's, again, it's such a beautiful, I see a couple little small cracks in the finish from my banging on it. But I mean, I have two beautiful guitars. I'm so happy with, and I can't wait till I really can have both of them on the road with me, you know, and really be selective. I mean, one of the first guitar drumming guitars I had where the pickup sounded incredible was actually an Ovation. I was doing it on a shallow back Ovation because there was one song with Pink that I sort of suggested that I do play some guitar on. And I started doing my guitar drumming with Pink. It was crazy that I felt, talk about being confident about something different. Sometimes I surprise myself when I think back to that. And I do remember at one point her saying, I love you on the keyboard so much. I love you on the keyboards. And I was like, point taken. I was trying to do too much with her. Mm-hmm. So when I first started with OAR, I was like, okay, well, maybe these guys will let me do all those things. And they were like, yep, thank you. Percussion, djembe, timbales, two keyboards, bongos, hand percussion, microphone for backing vocals, all my toys. Yeah.
Which instrument do you feel like is your home base? Like the one you go to when you're having a bad day and you want to just pick up something to play, which one do you pick up?
I mean, I don't pick it up, but I sit down behind a piano and play. Yeah. There's nothing really better than that for me. That's the first instrument that I started playing, 4 years old. So feeling the resonance of the strings and the feel, that's the most therapeutic instrument for me, definitely. And the most sort of second nature, I guess. I mean, guitar drumming has become very second nature to me, which is really cool. But it's a real piano. Anytime we're on tour, we play like a performance art center like SPAC or someplace like that that has like Steinway grand pianos in a room somewhere. I always go and find them and I'll just do all my warm up and I'll play through the set list, the songs from the set list on this incredible concert Steinway grand piano. And and I'll have the lights down. Nothing feels better than that. When I was in college and I was feeling really insecure about my piano playing because I was in the jazz program and these jazz players from all over the world came to study with Jackie McLean and all these people at the Hart School of Music. And I was like, I just kind of wanted to do jazz because I was in the jazz band. I really want to write songs. And I was feeling really like bad about my talents and skills because there was these jazz players, these piano players that were like worlds further along than I was. So at night I would go and find a teacher's room, which sometimes they would leave them unlocked, piano teacher's rooms on the top floor of the building. And I would just go in there with the lights down and just play by myself to sort of remind myself that you can play. Maybe this isn't what you should be focusing on, this jazz stuff, but you can play. Just you need to do your own thing. And once I switched to music composition, it was just broad and open and I could do whatever I wanted. But there's always been that at the worst of times, if I can get to a piano, I'll always feel better.
You know, what you're saying there is something we've heard from other musicians as well, that there are these moments of self-doubt or insecurity, even though you have fans who enjoy what you create and see kind of the finished product as opposed to the process. Can you talk about kind of overcoming that insecurity, vulnerability that you might feel when you're in front of people and maybe playing solo versus a band, that here, this is yours. This is your material that you're putting out into the world. And now it's up for criticism. It's up for people's opinions. Can you talk about that and being the artist subjected to those opinions?
Sure. I think for me, it was like anything else, just doing it and doing it. You know, those first solo shows that I started playing after I'd been playing with the band for years and years and years. And even when I was performing in Stomp and I was trying to perform solo shows in New York City, I was incredibly nervous and I wasn't doing it regularly. So it would be like every now and then I would do it. So I'd have to sort of really switch gears and get into that headspace. So it was incredibly nerve-wracking, and I felt judged incredibly by any audience that would show up, really. And I didn't really have the tools then to sort of figure out how to overcome that. And then I just decided recently, again, I just need to start booking. I'm releasing songs. I need to start booking. I need to start playing. And until I really can, you know, make it worthwhile bringing more people out on tour with me, it's just going to be me. So let me figure out, the more I've done it, the more I've believed in what I'm doing and that the songs are strong and that this guitar drumming thing isn't a gimmick. It's actually something that excites people and is something different and new for people to see. And incorporating the Stomp platform as part of my history of my development as a musician, there's all these, it's like I've created my own little world, kind of. I have my two microphones clean, my little distorted. And these are all things that I dreamt about in my head when I was thinking about my solo show. So finally having them realized and everything working, you know, and figuring out how to mic things and the cabling and all that stuff. Once the technical issues for me are removed, that's the thing that starts getting to me the most. If I'm, if like, what, where's that buzz coming from? And I've had to learn to let that stuff go too, though, because there's generally going to be something that goes awry at any show, right? There's going to be something, work the problem. Don't get freaked out about it. Okay, there's water dripping in the middle of the show and it's landing on my pedals. Just keep going.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
I mean, okay, you don't want to get electrocuted, but don't have that ruin your night. Things like that, even if it's a small, small little thing, or I screwed up a note, or I messed up a passage in a song or something. They don't know. They have no idea. Only you know. Don't get all, you know, there's that idea about there's always one person in the audience looking at you. If you always internalize that, you're always going to be performing and aware. And if you screw something up and you show that on your face physically or get all upset, that one person is going to see it, you know, and there's probably more. So there's this, so it's overcoming all those things. But for me, and I think maybe that's something that does help as a musician, is making sure you have the tools that really you can rely on. That I know my guitar is going to sound great. I got a new battery. It's in tune. The strings are in good shape. All my cabling's good. I got my little world that I've created up here. When I perform now, I wear in-ears, so I don't have to get distracted by hearing people talking if they're talking or whatever. Whatever, if I'm playing in a cool brewery or something.
And you
whatever.
Wear in-ears, you know, on your solo shows?
Someone shaking a drink. Solo shows.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it's just, I think the fact that I've been able to sonically and gear wise really have this stability in my show, it's allowed me to, in my solo show, sometimes play a room where maybe only 10 people showed up tonight. And it's the same thing with playing with the band, as far as how to get over those nerves. If you're playing with other artists, don't even worry about the audience, you know, just focus on whoever else is on stage with you, you know, and focus on the joy of the fact that you're all presenting these songs and giving them life organically in this moment. Sometimes when we've played shows, even with OAR, and we've played somewhere since in my 20 years where this, you know, it wasn't a great showing. It was a smaller venue or something. It was always about, we're right here. This is what the most important thing is, us believing in what we're doing and enjoying this experience. And yeah, you got to look out there. I'm not saying ignore the audience, but keep coming back to us on stage. Look at, let's connect. Let's keep this connection strong up here. I think that's part of it for me, has always been. It's your little world. Regardless of what stage you're on, you take that little world with you. Your gear that you know works, your guitars, your keys, whatever the instruments are, your voice, and how you're hearing things is as consistent as possible. That's something I learned too with doing my solo shows, is that going into situations where I'm setting up my own gear, I don't even necessarily know what the front of house situation is. Who's mixing me? Am I pre-mixing myself? Am I bringing my own PA? You know, so I strive to find as much consistency within that framework as possible. And that, again, meant just sort of creating my world, having my in-ears, making sure I can hear my voice, all my instruments exactly how I want to hear them. So I pre-mix my ears. I have like my own little ear mixer. So on the fly, I can just reach over and go, I need a little more vocal, or the stomping isn't quite loud enough. Let me hear more of that. And then I think it's also just repetition, and not getting freaked out about bad experiences or things going wrong and deciding, you know what, forget it. it's those challenges, I think, and those hurdles that sometimes one might say in your sort of, okay, I got to overcome these, and there's going to be good things that come out of that if I do. And so that's always been my attitude as far as not allowing screw ups and technical things during my solo shows or any show that I play to start up, you know, to bring me down, to take me out of the magic, to take me out of being in that moment of otherworldliness, which is just such an incredible thing that you can't describe. Even people that come and we all go and watch concerts, even musicians, we all go and you can't, it's something difficult to put into words how it makes one feel, I guess. Like any of those other intangible things, that's not a physical thing, you know, music exists, you know, we hear whatever. That's a whole other debate, I guess, too, or discussion. But I think that for me, that it was all those pieces put together and then just experience and just doing it and doing it and doing it and not being afraid to go back to your songs also and look at them again, like we were talking about earlier, or have someone else give that perspective so that they get better. They become the best that they can possibly be. And sometimes that is having someone else's ears on it and someone else's creative ideas infused in it. And then sometimes it's not. Some of the best music I think that has ever been created was done by just one person playing everything, you know? and so there's, that's rare, right? That's the rare thing. But I love creating with other people. It's this, you know, as much as I love being by myself in the studio and going into that zone and that headspace where nothing else exists in the entire universe except for this creative moment, I still love being with other musicians. And because that's the conversation. I talk to myself all the time when I'm by myself, you know, but it's not as much fun as talking with other people. Well, it can be sometimes, I guess.
Depends on the conversation.
It depends on the conversation, right? And what version of yourself you're speaking with in your brain or whatever you think is what happens there. I don't know.
When you're live on stage with the band, are there any specific moments that stand out for you of like highlights of the show, whether it's a solo, a call and response moment, some song that seems to resonate with the crowd? So is there a moment in an OAR show that stands out to you as like, yes, we're here?
There's not just one, mm-hmm. I think. And again, I think that moment happens every time I perform with the band, but it's not always the same moment. It's not always the same song, the same moment in a song. Sometimes it's not a song at all, but something that happened in between two songs. Some transitional piece. Yeah, it's hard to say, you know, when this song at this moment, when I do this, that always gives me chills or, you know, but there's, you know, there's different, I guess different songs make you feel different ways, right? And also from one night to the next, a song can make me feel differently, the same song playing it because of it's a little different energy. Yeah, so there's moments every night, every time I play with the band. There's moments for the most part when I play my solo stuff too. And I think it's perfectly acceptable and okay to be able to play your own songs and listen to your own music and give yourself chills and goosebumps. I have no problem with that. And so I'm thankful that every now and then that happens when I'm like listening to a song like Be Good to Me sometimes, or playing that song from Snidbits. It's still a guitar drumming song, but it's not on guitar drumming one. It was on the last record. For some reason, there's something about that song at certain points where the instrumentation of it shouldn't have been any differently. That was the right combination of elements and timbres and how it was mixed and mastered. There's just something about that that just all of a sudden just resonates like in my body. And that's an exciting feeling. I'm so thankful. And that also, I think, helps give one confidence to keep doing your own thing. I think is if you can move yourself by listening to what you created or looking at what you created, anything that anybody creates, right? If it can move you, how it can move other people, I think that's incredible and really special. And I never understood artists and people who were like, I can't watch myself, or I can't listen to myself, I can't listen to my recordings, I can't watch my movies, or I don't like hearing how my voice sounds. And I get that, like, it's weird to hear your voice sometimes, you're not used to it, but then why are you doing it? If you can't then go listen or watch and look at it and get joy from it. If you're just doing it to give joy to others, that I guess that's okay, that's fine, whatever, but I don't know. Where are you getting, if you're just getting the joy from the writing and the creating and in the studio and recording, okay. But for me, like I said earlier, the big payoff has always been getting to perform. That's, you know, even when I was in theater and doing all, you know, minoring in theater and in, you know, regional theater and little theater in Manchester and all that stuff, you know, there's that feeling of being able to just be on stage and connect with the people you're on stage with and the audience in this magical way. I mean, this has gone back since the beginning of time, or maybe the beginning of time, but whatever. It's gone back a long way.
Across cultures and time.
Entertainment, people trying to make people laugh or awe or musical expressions. You know, I mean, one could say that, and this is something that Luke would talk about all the time from Stomp, was we hear our mother's heartbeat when we're in the womb. And that's rhythm. We're hearing music from the very beginnings of our existence here, you know, so music and rhythm has been a part of us since the beginning, you know. And then they go and find these discoveries where they're hearing like pitches being emitted from neutron stars and stuff. You know, they're hearing the music of the universe.
Yeah,
and
it's measuring the frequency.
It's everywhere. Yep. So there's something. And so you hear artists sometimes talk about that, feeling like they're connected to the universe or this bigger thing. And in some ways it feels like that makes sense, you know, like, okay, we're tapping into this music that's created, that's part of the universe that we exist in already. It's all around us somehow.
That makes me think of, I told the story once before on the podcast, but when I was a student, I needed to test the hearing of what I would call the lowest cognitive functioning human I ever encountered. Somebody who wouldn't know to step, like lift their foot to walk up a step. And we were trying to figure out, what do we do? So we ultimately tested him like we would test a baby, and we're playing sound out of a speaker. We're not getting a response. But then we played children's songs, and the person would start bopping in their chair. And it was fascinating to see how even somebody who had the most basic of basic function still responded to music, and it physically moved their body. That it was a fascinating moment to see and kind of recognize that maybe this is why music is across time and culture, that it's just innate.
Yeah.
Everyone can relate to it in some way.
There's this philosophy too. There's this Princeton couple, I think, that created this thing called Music Together, and their whole philosophy, they have classes for kids up to like 5 years old, I think. So it's infants. And their whole philosophy is that you can, before you can talk, you can sing on pitch. Before we can learn any words or anything, we're already making sounds and noises. And if you encourage that in an infant before they can even talk, then their musical education is starting, you know, right at the beginning. And I've witnessed classes, you know, and watched these infants with their parents or one caregiver unable to talk, but singing in pitch these simple melodies and intervals that they've researched and figured out. It's fascinating. I mean, so we don't have to get into that, but that's why we have these discussions and we all are on the same table about that. And then, you know, whatever. The first thing to get cut always is the music and the arts and the theater.
You know what? I actually, because you're so multifaceted that we have OAR, we have Stomp, we have your solo stuff. I want to hear all about Toon Trek and what started that and any particular locations that have been meaningful to you. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Toon Trek. It was like 2012. And there was a lot going on just personally, and there was transitions going on kind of with the band and getting off of the major record label. It was a transitional period, I think, for a lot of us. And then I was also realizing that I was kind of getting a little complacent on tour. I was just like hanging on the tour bus, staying in the venue parking lot, not having adventures and exploring anymore, which as a kid, that's the first thing I wanted to do when I got home, was go in the backyard and go in the woods and have adventures. It was always about finding something new, the next tree that I didn't climb or rock to look under, and a new trail that I found. It was always that sense of adventure and exploration for me. And so I was like, what am I doing? And so I realized maybe I should find something to really motivate me when I'm on tour to go and have adventure. I need some, you know, if I'm just going to say, oh, I should just go do this and wake up early, then I'm going to be, I was just being lazy. I was just like, this tour life is amazing. And I'm just playing music and being this musician, and I don't have to worry about anything else. And then I realized that, okay, I need to I need to bring that back in my life. So I just started brainstorming. What are all my favorite things? What can I do to get me out of the area that I'm in these cities and towns, and discover things? And I've always been a big fan of just historical places, not necessarily history class in high school. I didn't have a good teacher. That didn't make it easy. But I've always been enamored with that feeling of going into a place with rich history for the first time. And really, and saying, oh my God, all the things that have happened here. Has there been music here? Has people sung here before? You know? And so it was this, it started to coalesce. And I did some testing in New York around where I lived, and went to like a pond and took my guitar and tried to figure out some cameras that I could use and how am I recording audio, you know? And I was really inspired by Live at Daryl's House. I was really inspired by Les Stroud, Survivor Man. I was really inspired by Anthony Bourdain. Mm. These people that had these shows that seemed different and a little more sort of guerrilla and a lot, especially Les Stroud, he would set up all his own cameras. He was by himself. He was composing the music for that show, playing harmonica and all that stuff. So I just started experimenting, and then talk about being nervous about something and believing in an idea, right? I remember that first phone call where I started doing research. I saw where OER was going to be 2012. I started, okay. One of the places was Red Rocks. That was one of the first Toon Tricks I ever filmed. And I started researching places and sending emails and trying to figure out what my pitch was. How am I describing what I'm doing? I didn't even know what the show really was at that point. And I got that.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
First phone call, and I was just trying to, like, what is the elevator pitch? How am I describing this? And she said, this sounds incredible. Yes, we would love to have you, because usually we're on the phone talking with people about financing and money and donations and all this stuff. You want to come here and perform and film a project about our place and maybe shed some light on this lesser known location? Yes.
It's a win for everybody.
It's a win for everybody. And so for the most part, it was just people were open. Every now and then I would have to get a filming permit. So the idea came, and I did those first couple and started to figure out format. And I knew I wanted to interview an historian, and how am I holding the cameras and telling the story? And then it evolved into, and I want to write a song for this place and then perform it. And then I want to look at these structures as almost like studios, where I'm going to do some stomping in that room because of the acoustics. I'm going to play guitar and sing in here. Or maybe this place has a piano. Oh my God, this place has a piano. I'm going to play a piano song. But I'm still going to do some beatboxing over there in the corner because there's a cool wallpaper thing or whatever. So it just became this incredible, you know, there were times where I would film a Toon Trek the day of a stomp show. There's one in New Haven I did at Trinity Church. It's like 210 years old now, I think, right in the square there. And I remember I went over at like 11 a.m., filmed the interview. And then I went back to the venue, did sound check with the band, went back to the church, got my guitar, performed, did my stomping. One of the songs that I did there was I'm going to be on Guitar Drumming 2, the next album. So initially I was just playing songs that I'd already written. So I would go in and play like three or four songs. Which one seems to resonate thematically or have the right feel? And then I started talking with Canon, and they wanted to do a documentary, you can see it on my YouTube channel, about I went and pitched them Toon Trek, and they were like, this is really cool. You can use Canon cameras and gear. We got this new camera you could use. And so I did this multi-part documentary in College Point, the Papenhuyzen Institute, very fascinating place. And that was the motivation for me to say, okay, I need to start writing songs for these Toon Trek locations. And as far as places that have been favorites, I've done 69 locations over the past 12 years, 13 years. I learned a lot. And my rig and my gear is vastly improved. And now I'm shooting in 4K and everything. It's great. And it's, again, king of the castle. No one telling me what I have to do or how I have to do it. I'm doing storyboards. I'm editing organically, doing a tour with the historian, asking questions, trying to make them just feel comfortable to just talk about. Just tell me stories about the place. What happened here? You know, tell me stories. And then trying as much as possible to integrate the historian into the performance. The Absecon Lighthouse in Atlantic City.
Yep.
I was the first and only person, as far as I know, to ever play music at the top of the lighthouse. And the lighthouse keeper, Buddy, at the time of the filming, he was 88. And he was still climbing up and down the stairs like multiple times a week. And then when I went back some years ago, he was still there. And I showed him. It was awesome. I showed him the Toon Trek episode. So he got to finally see it like 8 years older. He was like 94, 95 when I finally got to show it to him. It's been a whole different way for me to write music. I get to research, look at the stories of these places. And also, you know, there'll be 7 or 8 places that I'm considering. Which of these places seems different or the most interesting or a place I've never been to? And I've been to all sorts of incredible places, you know, ships and warehouses and just a lot of old houses. And it's endless. And I think I've only got maybe 12 or something on my website right now that are edited. But I'm doing all the editing. And that's so time intensive.
So, you guys,
of course. You
know, so I'm in Adobe Premiere and I'm, you know, and so next year, tentatively, I'm planning Michael Paris Toon Trek S1.
Awesome.
Like season one.
Awesome.
So it would be maybe 14 songs, 16 songs, and 16 companion Toon Trek episodes. So I'd sort of release them simultaneously with, you know, outtakes and special features and little clips for posting and all that stuff. And then, you know, I had 7 of them air on a couple PBS stations. So we explored this idea of Toon Treks being interstitials on PBS in between other programming. So they whittled them down to 90 seconds, you know, and it just got to the point where I was like, I want to tell more of the story. This 90 second thing isn't as rewarding. And then I went and did like a sort of a pilot episode at Sedona Mansion in Florida, beautiful place. And that was more like a 6-minute, 7-minute format. Because then in my brain, I was like, oh, I could do like a half hour episode and visit 3 locations with commercials or streaming or whatever, right? 20 minutes-ish, 22 minutes. Well, I'm trying to get some traction on it again next year. You know, I want to start looping back around to that Toon Trek because it certainly is unique.
Yeah,
it definitely is unique. And again, it incorporates all the things that I love, filmmaking and photography and music and travel and adventure and historical places and being sometimes alone in these places where the historian's like, oh, I got to go leave for a couple hours or something. I did one and okay. One of my favorites, I'll say it, is the Reed Gold Mine.
Where is that?
That is in Midland, North Carolina. So it's just outside of Charlotte.
Okay.
And the Reed Gold Mine is the first documented discovery of gold in the United States. Like that's the place where it was originally discovered. And then the westward expansion happened after that. But the Reed Gold Mine was just this little hill area with trees and woods. And this guy's son found this potato-sized rock-ish thing. And they used it as a doorstop for a while. And then at one point, someone else was like, you know, I think that's gold. And they went and took it. And then he sold it. And then all of a sudden, they were just finding these potato-sized golden all over the property. And so they built a mine there. And so I got to go in and I wrote a song. And again, I got to walk around those mines by myself for hours with like steady cam, getting B-roll footage, and then being in this incredible section of the mine with the guitar and singing and this, you know.
How are the acoustics down there?
Very dry.
Uh-huh.
In my brain, I was like, oh, tunnels. There's going to be reverb and some echo and stuff. No.
Interesting.
So dry. So dry. But the temperature and the air was so pleasant. Like you could live there. I mean, you wouldn't want to live there.
But sounds like
that was probably, and then, you know, I did a USS Olympia in Philly, which is like the oldest, I think, remaining steel-hulled warship still afloat from the 1800s. And that was awesome. I've always been into like the ships and aviations and stuff. Okay, the Carolina Aviation Museum.
Yeah, so I'll tell you did that. So maybe the Intrepid next.
I have a friend that has a connection with the Intrepid. Mm-hmm. You know, I try to... The thing about it is, for me too, being a one-man crew, mm-hmm. I try to have it something I can handle by myself. Like looking at the Intrepid, you know, it's like... I'm going to be here for a month filming. If I want to like see it all and explore it all and yeah. everything, you know, the cool thing about the USS Olympia was it was still a decent sized ship with turrets and everything on it, but it wasn't that big. Mm-hmm. So, but I do love the idea of going on an aircraft carrier. I would love to film one in a submarine. I think that would be really cool. It's endless. I want to take it overseas. I want to go see real old stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to go into a whole European Toon Trek series. You know, I could see myself even doing it by country too. Mm-hmm. Spain, you know, or Europe or whatever it is, Toon Trek Australia.
That would be awesome.
I think it'd be really, really cool. And because it's music based, you know, it's really driven by how these, the places inspire me to create mm-hmm. and to write. And as the show progressed, I was really trying to show my process more. In the Reed Goldmine is a perfect example of me coming up with some of the lyrics as I'm walking around with the historian. Ooh, that's a good lyric. And I would sing it back to myself, you know, and you hear it in the episode. So it's been a real exciting creative venture for me.
It's really like an all-encompassing creative process because it's visual, it's auditory, it's historical, it's
yep.
everything.
I know.
It's not just sound.
Yes. And I think for me, it's finding the niche and where, you know, where could it live? Where's the home for it? And what is the audience? Or what are the demographics that I think? I have no idea. You know, I have no idea. So, you know, I'm hoping that as things continue to grow for me as a solo artist, again, it's not until really last year that I really started releasing stuff and really starting to become prolific as my own, as the Michael Paris brand, I guess, mm-hmm. right? And again, a lot of this came out of the pandemic. It came out of looking at my hard drives all around my studio with all these songs and all these unfinished projects going, what are you doing? You know, you want to just, what happens? If you never know. Tomorrow you might not be here and you just got hard drives sitting around with all these things you've created. What's the sense in that? You know, this for me as a creative, right? That's my legacy. That's, mm-hmm. you know, when I'm not here anymore, it's like, those are the, part of the things that I'm going to be able to leave behind, right? And so I really stuck that fire under me and was like, you need to finish this. And so it's really only been since last year, really, at the beginning of the year, that I've really started releasing and really trying to hit this on the head and really book the Michael Paris solo tour within the OAR. How do I do that? And that's been a big struggle for me, you know? And that was, you know, when I had tried to do a little bit of that back in like 2010, it was a real struggle. I hadn't figured out the formula yet.
It's a lot of moving parts for coordinating all that.
What's the priority?
Yeah.
And the priority is the band, except in very certain circumstances where, okay, maybe I have a solo thing booked that's really important and the band has something and it's maybe a private thing and they can do without me. You know, but I hate missing shows. I never want to miss an OAR show. But yeah. that's the challenge now. That's been the experiment.
I'm Michelle's so sorry. I have to run off. I have multiple patients that are waiting to see me.
Bye,
so
Michelle.
I apologize. I'm sorry to cut you off, but
you as well.
I'm
that's
here.
Right. Nice meeting you. Thanks for hanging out. Bye.
I'm interested in photography, a Canon shooter, and just hearing about integrating all these different aspects of creativity and the way the space can influence you, and talking about like walking around with a historian and coming up with lyrics based on what that experience is in the moment. There's something that feels very authentic in that to me.
Yeah, it's no stress, no pressure. They have adopted that. So, and no rules when I'm doing my stuff, when I'm doing my stuff, I just, if it feels right, I'm going to keep pursuing that.
Does the OAR success give you the freedom to do whatever the hell you want to do on the creative end when it comes to TuneTrack or your solo projects? Does that allow you more latitude, or?
It means I don't have to have like a day job and being able to sort of stay as right brained as possible on a daily basis. I'm really happy and thankful for it. Yeah. So yes, but I think definitely being a part of the band and the organization, having that attached to my name certainly helps as I, you know, continue to pursue my solo stuff. Being able to say Michael Paris of OER at least opens a door.
Sure.
You know, it at least opens the conversation, or it doesn't, because they're like, oh, I'm not a fan of that band. Whatever. You know what I mean? How rare that is, I'm sure, for someone not.
But the way you describe, the way you're talking about your projects, it sounds to me like there's a passion in it that you're finding meaning in what you're doing. You're finding something of substance in it that is the driving force. It's not necessarily, as I'm hearing you speak, for the audience. It's for you. And because you're feeling moved by it, then there's a good chance there's going to be other people that are going to feel something from your work.
Right.
That's what it sounds like is the guiding, the real impetus behind what you're doing, that it's just what you're interested in and what feels right.
Yeah, and it never feels like work, you know, even when I'm working my butt off and setting up all of my stuff for whatever solo thing I'm doing and then breaking it down and doing it. You know, I got my first camera when I was 9. My grandmother bought it for me. I was developing black and white film when I was 9 years old. Like it.
What did you shoot with back then?
The first camera I had was a Pentax.
K1.
No, it was a Pentax, and these are all film cameras. You know,
the manual.
With the manual advance, and
yep.
The shutter was a little wonky on it.
Yep.
It was my grandmother bought it for me, so she got it from somewhere. I don't know where she got it from. But then my Minolta XG1 was my first, like, kind of, oh, and I got the big zoom lens on and everything. That way, I would love that so much. You know, that's when I really got into, like, bird photography. Mm-hmm. I would stand outside in my backyard and have the bird feeders and just stand there with my zoom lens.
Just wait.
Wait, here it comes. I hear him. There he is. So, yeah, it just, the idea of it being work, it's a lot of work. But it never really feels like work, because it always feels like I am working on either something that I've created or am creating, or I'm working on something that I have adopted.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Adopted as my own creation. So it's always feeding that hunger and that desire for creativity and to just to, you know, to build and explore and always just experiment. And for me, if I'm not happy, how can anyone else around me be happy, or how can I look at the world in a positive way? So I have to feed. It's a monster, you know. I'm feeding the creative monster all the time, and there's times where it's all consuming and it's almost manic, you know. It's almost like I'm going crazy. You know, there's times where you hear things, just you can't sleep. It's just this, you're writing at something, or you hear a melody and you can't turn your brain off. And we all have that problem where we can't turn our brains off. But for me, it was, as a kid, I remember I was writing symphonies in my head when I'm half in and out of sleep, and the air conditioner is in the window doing this rhythm thing. And everything kind of was like, and I would get into these weird trances where I was just like composing. So it feels at times, and I'm not complaining. I'm thankful, you know, but But now it's just, I just gotta get it all out. I just gotta get it out, you know, and as much as I want as many people to hear it on the planet as possible, and I'm trying to be way more proactive now about the business side of what my brand is and how much can I realistically do by myself, as much as I like doing everything by myself. If I really want to get on a good tour opening up for somebody, regardless of whether I have people's phone numbers in my phone or not, that I can hit up an artist and say, hey, I'd love to be support for you. I see you're good. There's all these other things involved. We know it's management, it's label and all this other stuff. So I'm really trying to put together some
play sort that of team. Game.
I just am accepting it now. And I think I'm in a much better place in all respects than I was 20 years ago when I was trying to maybe do a similar thing, like real, okay, I'm going to be a musician. I'm not going to be on do theater. Now I'm going to be a musician. It was always one or the other, back and forth. That's why Stomp was so cool, because it was like this weird hybrid.
Mushed it all together. Were you in the production of Stomp that was in the Orpheum in the city?
Correct.
So my sister lived on 6th Street by Avenue A. I walked by that place all the time.
29 years.
Yeah, that was back.
29 years.
Yeah, that was probably like 96, 97.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I traveled all over the country with it and all over the world. Got to do incredible things. HBO Stomp Out Loud, Sesame Street, Mr. Rock, like these incredible experiences that I would have never had, you know,
without that tour.
It's we all have our journeys, and I feel a very good place now to just sort of be going for it and have a tougher skin, I think, you know, and like we were talking about earlier, sort of have this tool kit and these, I guess these skills I've learned of how to deal with certain situations and not get all bent out of shape and not taking things personally. I remember as an actor, I remember someone finally giving me guidance. If you don't get the part, because you're not going to get most of your parts, it's not because you suck, unless you really do suck, but it's because you weren't right for it, you know? Yeah. So, but with your song, it's so personal, you know, you're judging me as an actor right when I walk in the room. Do I look right for the role or not? Regardless, before I even open my mouth, do I fit it just physically how I look? With a song, it has nothing to do with that. People hear it, right?
When you think of your songs, do you feel like it's yours until that moment you put it out in the world, and then it's no longer yours because you shared it? No,
I always feel like they're mine.
Uh-huh. And fascinating with art.
It's interesting to see, you know, and I do like talking to people when I play shows too now. And like, so what was your favorite? What did you think? How did that make you feel? You know, trying to get feedback from people as I'm doing this process now too. What is seems to be resonating the most?
Are there people you'll go to who you feel like will give you that real feedback, not just what they think you want to hear?
This is just any random audience member, really. I have found that the people that are giving me feedback seem to be genuinely excited. And then not just, oh, that was great. I don't know. I feel like I've, because we all can do that if you just want to give someone a compliment because you're meeting them, but you didn't really necessarily love whatever. Yeah, that was cool. That was really cool. I don't know. It's interesting because with this guitar drumming thing, I feel like I'm able to captivate a crowd even before I start singing.
Because really there's a visual aspect to it also.
It's visual. I'll, you know, for some of my shows coming up, I'll bring my projector and I have this whole OBS rig with all this content that I've created for green screen and projectors. And so I've got visuals that I've filmed for certain songs. So there's this whole other component to it as well at some of my live shows, which harkens back to the live stream when it was all the green screen. So I have all this great content, and I've always loved the visual connection with the audio. And so I always try to work with artists for song covers and album covers. On Snidbits, I had a different artist do each song. So I've got 8 sort of their feelings, how that song resonated with them and what that inspired them to create visually. I love
visual that. Representation of that.
Yeah, I love that.
Awesome. So last question, I would go a little bit toward our area. Tell us about how you think about your hearing and your ears in the context of all your professional work and what you do to take care of them.
Interesting. I mean, I certainly have noticed changes to my hearing over the years. I've, you know, I wore earplugs through all of Stomp, but I know that that show affected my hearing.
Okay.
I never was on wedges, really, for the band, thankfully. We were all always in in-ears. But that can be dangerous, too, because you can start to ride the volume.
Yes.
I'm having trouble hearing. Ride the volume. You know, I never really have any drums in my ears because I'm pretty much hearing all of that. So I do think, but, you know, I've learned how to ride it, and I was always getting good advice about that. Mm-hmm. And that definitely, I think, has saved my hearing. But I notice the thing that I notice the most about my hearing now is like background noise, white noise, air conditioners, fans. If that shit is going on in a room, it makes it very difficult for me to hear conversation.
Yes. Yeah. Your brain.
Whatever
can't...
that is called. I know that I've that's
temporal processing.
Yeah. So that has definitely, that's gotten a little more challenging over the years because of all this assault that I've done. I mean, as far as taking care of them, again, it's like, I mean, I always have earplugs in my, even if it's just the foamies. I had some expensive ones and I lost them, so it's like, all right, let me just get the 33 foamies. And so I'm always wearing those. I mean, I probably can be doing more things to take better care of my ears. You know, I try to do the drops every now and then to just make sure I don't have too much buildup of wax in there. I do gentle irrigation when I can in the shower, just kind of let the water go in there a little bit. But it's also, I don't really do Q-tips except around the exterior. No, whatever. I'm not digging in there.
Yeah.
And then I love as much as possible just finding pockets of silence wherever I go. I love as much as possible just finding some place where it's just completely quiet. If it's just nature and the wind in the trees, or you're in some room somewhere where there's no sound, I try and find those places as often as possible. So I feel like that helps me maybe in some ways, maybe mentally more than anything else. But, you know, I'm just I wear my earplugs on when I'm riding the subway, you know, when I'm on the airplane. I'm trying to protect my ears as much as possible in my everyday, right, and in my performance. But I'm sure there's things that I can be doing better and for extended health of my ears, I'm sure. And I'm sure you have things that you can tell me or... Are you ever response to that?
No, you were on to something of the idea that with in-ears, you can still cause damage that doesn't matter if it's a wedge or an in-ear, it matters the intensity of your eardrum.
Right.
So one of the things we oftentimes recommend to artists is to practice with your in-ears in and take the volume slightly lower than what you would choose. Because if you practice at a intensity slightly lower than what you'd think would be comfortable, you'll adapt to that and then utilize that on stage in a way that can be very beneficial long term. It also seems like with the band, Nick certainly knows what he's doing in terms of getting you guys good mixes and at levels that work.
Yeah, usually. I mean, unless he's been hitting us off. But, you know, other than that, no, Nick is like, he's the best. Our front of house guy, Mike Larcy, was doing monitors for a while before Nick, and he was great too. But the two of them, it's like it couldn't be a more perfect team as far as people that are controlling the audio and the sound, both for us and the audience. Yeah, so, I mean, interesting about practicing with the in-ears.
Because the research shows that if musicians will select the same intensity from in-ears or from wedges, but if you practice with the in-ears at lower volumes, you'll adapt
lower
to that.
Volume. I mean, during, you know, when we do sound checks and we do that hour where we're just playing through songs, I have my pack really low. I have a wedge as well to the left of me. So I have a little bit of keyboards going into the wedge. So I sort of can feel it there a little bit. So I'm usually trying to get a blend of that. I just want to be able to really hear my vocal and then hear what I'm doing. And then obviously I need to hear Mark and other stuff. But then I kind of have that stuff. I want it to really try and sound as much like I'm listening to just a record in my ears. As possible, with a little more of my vocal and a little more of my keys. But that's definitely saving so many musicians here.
Yes, yes.
In the in-ears in general.
And when they're used properly.
And so, like I said, I use them for my solo show. And I probably ride them too hot during my solo show because I'm sort of closer to people, for the most part, in my solo shows than I am to OER as far as background noise from an audience. So I do think for my solo shows, I probably tend to ride the volume louder in my in-ears.
Are you using the same monitors you use with the band?
Yes. I tried molds and I just could never get mold. And I don't know, maybe I didn't have the right person doing it. They just never were comfortable and never really sealed.
We'll take care of you for that.
Okay, well, let's talk about that.
I just so did now Paul.
I used the Shore. Oh, that's right. I used the Shore 9 something, which just have different size.
Yeah, the little buds. Yep.
And they sound great. And I was able to go in. You were able to go in and swap out a little internal rod if you wanted it bright, neutral, or warm.
Okay. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Filters.
So I had it on a warm. I put the two warms in. And I like them. So that's what I use for the band now. And then that's what I use for my solo stuff. Is those Shure 985Es or whatever they are.
Interesting. I find the monitor conversations fascinating because there's so much that can be done these days. What was it specifically you didn't find comfortable about them? Like, would they slip out? Was it the sound?
No, it was just they one pair actually hurt to wear. Mm-hmm. And then the other pair didn't really seem to create a seal.
Okay, so fit it.
And I do know that there was one time where I went to get molds, and the person that was doing them was like, you have too much wax buildup in here that I don't want to, you need to go see a doctor. So, you know, I do need to do that. I do need to go have my ears. I got to make a physical appointment anyway, whatever. But I need to have that sorted so that if I was going to try and do molds again, I would need to make sure I have that looked at before.
Yeah, you get it cleared out first. Yeah, because there's definitely more options that are available than maybe people realize when it comes to what can be done with monitors to really make them work for you.
Okay. Well, I mean, maybe it's something that I can look into as we get into maybe early next year or something. Maybe, yeah, because Paul's just been showing, he's been showing his in-ears off, his emerald greens.
Yep.
And I keep making fun of him sort of for being like so showy-offy with him. And I was like, but you should be showing those off.
Yeah, his look pretty sharp. It's a pretty loud color.
I was like, what's your favorite color? And he just pointed. Yeah, he's great. You know, having this sort of, not new approach, but another energy, different type of energy in that bass position right now, however long it goes on for, is also really, I think, like I was talking about with my music, having that fresh pair of ears. Like Paul is really a fresh pair of ears on all these songs, and he's really working his butt off. He's got so many, you know, songs to learn, and he's been great. He's done solo stuff with me. We did a live stream from the Absecon Lighthouse, he and I, actually.
Okay, yep.
Not to bring that place up again. But he's played on some solo shows with me, and I like hanging out with Paulie.
Seems like a good dude.
Yeah, man.
So, hey, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you and connect with you and your music?
Okay. You can find me at mikelparis.com, and it's at mikelparis, all socials, Spotify as well. All my stuff is streaming on all the popular platforms. And then you can see me on tour. You can see some of my solo shows where I'll have vinyl with me, and I'll have merch and things that you can pick up. And I've got a new song coming out.
When's that
August
coming out?
29th.
Awesome.
With Brady Watt, featuring Brady Watt. So that's exciting. And then September, I'm going to have a song coming out with Of Good Nature, a second collab song with Of Good Nature, which I'm really excited about, a song I wrote during the pandemic. And then the Brady Watt song is a song, the newest song I wrote.
Very
and
cool.
And again, it's really fun to just be experimenting, continuing to experiment with how I write and the people that I write with. And I think that that's something we should all be doing as creatives, is always trying to experiment and grow as people. You hear that just from people, just educating ourselves, right? And learning something new every day stimulates the brain and keeps us feeling young and maybe even looking. You know, I'm 86. Okay.
Looking good.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Signature, and these are trademarks, so no one copy my signature crescent moon sideburns.
There you go.
They are trademarked. No, they're not. But I should. I should trademark them.
All right.
It's been so great talking to
you. Yeah, Michael Paris, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for sharing your story, your work. We're going to link to everything in the episode description. And it's been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for coming on Hear Us Out.
See you next time.